Ave podcast listeners, a quick notice before we get started on today's podcast. Today and for the next few episodes, we'll be joined by Caelan Davenport and we'll be hearing about the rule of Valerian. Valerian ruled in the middle of the 3rd century, right during that very turbulent time of civil wars and high emperor turnover. If you would like to catch up on what's happened previously to this, then trawl back through the podcast archives. You're looking for, say, around episode CLXIV. And so on that note, enjoy the podcast. Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Associate Professor Caelan Davenport, head of the Centre for Classical Studies at the Australian National University. This is episode CXCI, Empire Under Siege. When Valerian became emperor in 253 CE, Rome was fighting on all fronts. With Chapor and the Syrians taking territory in the east, and the Germanic tribes to the west and the north, the empire was going to get messy for Valerian and his newly established dynasty. Here's Caelan Davenport.
Decius and his son, Herennius Etruscus, were last seen riding valiantly into battle at the Battle of Apertus against the Goths. After their death, one of the governors in the region, a senator known as Trebonianus Gallus, was acclaimed emperor, and he made Decius' second son, Hostilianus, part of his imperial college, along with his own son, Volusianus. So we have an imperial college of three again. Hostilianus dies of the plague, not in suspicious circumstances, because we talked about the so-called plague of Cyprian, which was raging throughout the empire. However, Trebonianus Gallus himself didn't last very long because in 253, one of his governors, Aemilius Aemilianus, revolted against him. So we're having quite a regular turnover of dynasties due to soldiers acclaiming provincial governors as emperor because they think they can do a better job than the current ruler.
Yeah, and this will be a trend that very much continues, and also in a trend that continues, Trebonius Gallus is essentially done in by his own soldiers who see a better offer on the horizon.
Yes, this all happens in central Italy, which is quite interesting that civil war has returned to central Italy again. You know, if we think back to the year of the four emperors, AD 69, we saw how Italy was very much a battle zone. That happens again at this point. So Trebonianus Gallus, his son, are killed by their troops outside Interamna. Aemilius Aemilianus is then murdered by his troops outside Spoleto. And the reason they do away with him is that Valerian, who is a senatorial commander, had been called by Trebonianus Gallus to bring troops from the German provinces to his rescue. Valerian fails to rescue Trebonianus Gallus, but the troops of Aemilianus also think that he is going to make a better emperor.
Okay, so this is the man who will become emperor and will be the focus of the next few episodes of Emperors of Rome. Yeah. So let's go into a bit of background on him and get to know him, or at least what little we can know about him, and then maybe talk about what sort of Rome he inherits.
Valerian is going to last for 7 years, which is quite exceptional for this period. So it is worth taking some time to get to know him. So he's a senator. He was born probably in the 190s. So he's likely to be in his late 50s by now. So, you know, he's born into the Severan Empire when, you know, things are going fairly well. Septimius Severus is a good emperor, a good general. And certainly, even though it has its ups and downs, the Severan dynasty does last for a while. He's married to a woman of good birth, also from an Italian senatorial family, Ignatia Mariniana. But she dies before he becomes emperor. We know that because coins honouring her as a diwa, as deified goddess, are minted early on in his reign. But he has married again to a woman called Cornelia Galonia. And the only reason we know about this second marriage is because of an inscription which was found about 20 years ago in Sardinia that records this second marriage. And she is also elevated to the rank of Augusta. So He has two sons, which is important for the succession once he becomes emperor.
Mm.
The first is Publius Licinius Ignatius Gallienus, who will play a very important role in our story. And he was born from the relationship with Mariniana. Now, the second son is quite a shadowy figure, Licinius Valerianus. It's been suggested he could be a half-brother to Gallienus, born from Gallonia. But he is really kept out of the limelight. All we know that he was consul, and then he was consul for the second time in 265, which is obviously a prestigious honour, but he's never made Caesar, he's never made Augustus, and one of the reasons we know about him is a couple of shadowy references in the literary sources, but also an inscription from Aphrodisias in Asia Minor, where a statue is set up in his honour, and it says that he is the son and brother of Augusti. So a son and brother of an emperor.
Mm.
But we don't have enough literary sources to piece together why he did not become Caesar Augustus. Maybe he didn't want to. It's been speculated that, you know, he may not have been a military man. We just don't know. It's an intriguing question as why everything goes to Gallienus and virtually nothing to Valerianus apart from the consulships.
Yeah, yeah, it's interesting. You'd think that, you know, you would be eager to keep as much of the bloodline involved in the Caesars as you can at that point, especially when during this reign you've got so many fronts to fight on.
So, exactly, yeah. Exactly.
So the indication that we get about Valerian at this point in his career is that he is, unusually for an emperor, I guess at this point, a trusted senator with, yes, with a good track record. His resume, his LinkedIn profile, gets a green tick.
It definitely does, yes. He's had a couple of appearances on the stage so far. He seems to have been a legate of Gordian I. That's the proconsul of Africa, who was then elevated.
Very briefly.
Exactly, very briefly.
Didn't even make it to Rome, did he?
No. Yes, it all ended very sadly in Africa. Yes, Valerian got out while there was still time. So Valerian was actually sent as an ambassador by Gordian to Rome. But of course, it all fell apart in Africa. There are some stories about him holding a prominent role under Decius as censor, a position which no longer existed. It had been part of the imperial office since the time of Domitian, since Domitian declared himself censor perpetuus, censor forever. So this seems to be a made-up story that exists in the Historia Augusta. But he was clearly a senior senator. We know he was in Raetia and Noricum, so that's sort of modern-day southern Germany, Switzerland, probably as a governor in command of troops in the reign of Trebonianus Gallus. And Aurelius Victor has this really interesting comment about him, and this is in his book on the Caesars, 32.2. Victor says, "Valerian, although of a reasonably distinguished family, was nevertheless pursuing a military career, as was still the custom at that time." Now, Victor is writing from the perspective of the late 4th century.
Mm.
Senators do not command troops at that time. And indeed, the turning point is going to come very soon in the reign of Gallienus, when senators are going to be excluded from the command of troops in battle.
Okay.
So what Victor is saying here is that in the 250s, it was still standard practice for senators to command not only legions, but also vexillations, which are detachments made up of groups from lots of different legions. It comes from the Latin word vexillum, the flag or the standard. So he's saying, you know, this was the time senators, they were still ruling the roost. So it's, you know, expected for Valerian to have this kind of military career.
Mm. So Trebonianus Gallus sends out the signal and asks Valerian for help, and Valerian comes with his army and arrives too late to be of help.
That's right, yes.
It's implied that's intentional.
Yes, you know, it would certainly be a strategic decision to just stand back and see what happened and then sweep in afterwards. But whatever happened, you know, Valerian was the man on the scene with significant detachments of troops from the northern army. So he was, you know, the right and inevitable choice to be the next emperor.
So Valerian is acclaimed the emperor by the troops, uncontested, I guess, for our purposes. So what kind of Rome does he inherit at this point?
Well, it's a Rome with considerable pressure on the frontiers. So, you know, it's still reeling from the loss of Decius and his son, a significant portion of the expeditionary army at the Battle of Abratus. The Goths are still pressing on the Danubian frontier there. We're also going to see raids from what are called the Black Sea Goths that travel by ship down to Greece and then down to the coast of Western Asia Minor, modern day Turkey. And of course, we still have Shapur, the Shahanshah, the king of kings of the Persian Empire, who you might remember from a couple of episodes, you know, had defeated Gordian III. Mm. Philip had paid him off, but he's still there and he is still wants to bring Roman territory under the control of his empire.
Yeah,
so it's quite an unstable situation with threats on multiple fronts.
Yeah, it's interesting that Shapur has been in power for so long. That looks like a stable empire the Persians have at the time.
Definitely. He is the undisputed leader.
Mm. Okay, so Valerian then arrives in Rome around September, October 253, and he very quickly moves to establish a solid dynasty. He's got two grown sons, as we say, but one who is definitely favoured.
Yes. Gallienus, who's in his mid-30s, is made co-Augustus, so there's no promotion to an intermediate rank of Caesar. He's made full co-emperor from the beginning. The Senate agrees to that decision. And Gallienus himself, now being a man in his mid-30s, has a family with two sons. So he's married to a woman known as Cornelia Salonina. She'll play an important role in our Gallienus episodes.
Mm.
And they have two sons. I'm not going to give their full names because we'll just get so confused. There's Valerian Jr. He's the elder. And then there's Saloninus.
Okay.
This shows how difficult it is to parse the family dynamics this period. There's possibly a third son, Marinianus, who is a consul in 268. And the reason he's definitely a relative is that Valerian's first wife was called Ignatia Mariniana.
Okay.
Yeah. So he's definitely a relative. And there's suggestions from the coinage that he could be a young boy or he could be another relative altogether.
Mm.
But what we have here is three generations. We have grandfather, father, and then we have the sons there. The Valerianic dynasty has great potential from the beginning to be a stable government.
Mm-hmm. But the two younger sons of Gallienus, they aren't established as Caesars yet at this point. That seems to come later on down the track when there's almost a military need to have members of the imperial family in certain places where they're a bit visible.
That's right, yes. We're not even sure of their age. Mm. But yes, they'll be made Caesars in turn, but at the moment they're not elevated to any rank.
Okay, so while we still have him, what do we know about Valerian as an emperor? He spends a lot of his reign on the front lines, pretty much.
Yeah, he spends most of his reign outside Rome, as emperors were expected to do at this stage. So you might remember back to the reign of poor old Severus Alexander, when he was summoned to the frontiers by his governors to help with the Persian incursion. This was expected of him, that he be there in person.
Mm.
Views of Valerian are mixed, and this is particularly because, I don't know whether I should give a spoiler alert here, of the way in which he ends his reign.
Mm.
He ends his reign in a disgraceful fashion. So we have a pendulum from the Epitome de Caesaribus, the short book on the Caesars that says he was stupid and extremely indolent, while Zosimus, who's probably relied on Dexippus, who is a contemporary, said he was popular and anxious to be a good administrator. The Historia Augusta is quite interesting because we actually pick up with the Historia Augusta again. You might remember that many of the lives of Philip and Decius have been lost, and the manuscript picks up towards the end of Valerian's life. And the HA says in what is now 5.1 of the life of Valerian, "That is all that is worthy of being known about Valerian, whose life, praiseworthy for 60 years long, finally rose to such glory that after holding all honours and offices with great distinction, he was chosen emperor. Not, as often happens in a riotous assemblage of the people, or by the shouting of soldiers, but solely by right of his services, and, as it were, by the single voice of the entire world. Now, there's a lot that's inaccurate about that. You know, he was elected by the soldiers, but it gives the sense that Valerian was a good emperor, a good administrator, the right person to be chosen as emperor at the time. And certainly, you know, he does the right thing straight away. You know, he makes his son Gallienus Augustus, and the idea is that because there's two of them, they can go to different frontiers throughout the empire to tackle the threats. So he has a plan from the beginning.
Mm. So with the empire under pressure, Shapur in the east, Goths to the north, and Gauls being opportunistic, the Germanic kind of tribes.
They're okay at the moment, though there are signs of tension there, which will force some movements to the Rhine frontier.
Okay, so watch that space,
watch
essentially.
That space, yeah.
How does Valerian divide the labour? He's got himself, he's got an heir. Essentially, it's you take that side of the empire, I'll take this side of the empire.
Yes, so Valerian goes to the east to meet Shapur, and Gallienus is sent to the Balkans to deal with the Gothic incursions there. Valerian's brother-in-law, the senator Lucius Egnatius Victor Lollianus, is left in charge of Rome as urban prefect. So he's using the family network that way to make sure that Rome is looked after. And this is something that becomes increasingly common in the 3rd century, is with the emperor outside of Rome, they look to make sure there is some sort of imperial presence in Rome with a relative.
Okay. So shall we talk before we concentrate on Valerian, what's going on with the Goths, who have quite recently had a big victory, they would see it, in the Battle of Abratus. Also, they're just in it for the smash and grab aspects of it. They're not after territory, they're after a bit of raiding.
They're after booty and slaves as well. So we saw how, for example, when they invaded Moesia and northern Greece under Decius, that they enslaved a considerable portion of the population there.
Yeah.
But yes, no, they're not looking to settle, which makes them different from other northern tribes we'll encounter later in the 3rd century and into the 4th century.
So are the Goths coordinated in their efforts? They're not, are they? You've got Shapur with an empire. He's leading an empire. He's after territory. The Goths are just a lot of, I don't want to say opportunistic, but they're raiding from a lot of different directions.
That's right. And there are different groups as well. So we're dealing here with two major groups. One group, which is called the Scythians. And, you know, this is a classicizing term used by our Greek historians. Scythians is, of course, what people like Herodotus called the residents of these regions. And so we have authors like Dexippus and then Zosimus, who uses Dexippus, using the term Scythians to describe them. The other group are what we call the Borani, who seem to be a Germanic people as well, that come from the same region. It may be the case that they're identical with a group called the Bulani, who are mentioned in Ptolemy's geography. So we probably have at least two different groups here that are raiding, but not in a coordinated fashion. There's no overarching grand strategy. What we'll see is that they target specific cities, often those on the coast, and then they move on, either if they've been repelled or when they've taken booty or they've enslaved people.
We've got Black Sea Goths.
Yes. The Black Sea Goths raided Thessalonica in northern Greece, then sailed across the Hellespont into Asia, and they even burned the Temple of Artemis at Ephesus during this raid. It's one of the seven wonders of the ancient world.
About to say that, that's wonders of the world. Name drop.
Exactly. You know, and of course, you know, temples have treasures. That's one of the reasons they're targeted. Now, if you go to Ephesus, you can see the one column still standing of the temple.
The one column that they put back up?
Yeah. I think it's been restored, so you can have your nice photos next to it. It's in a bit of a swamp, really. It's not the nicest site to visit.
Valerian spends most of his reign, especially at this point, in the east. So shall we go with what is Shapur doing in the East? What sort of territory is he taking? How much of a presence does he have in the area?
Shapur becomes a problem again in 253. That is the year that Valerian becomes emperor. And you might remember that Philip had paid him off after the defeat of Gordian III and then Gordian's death.
It was meant to be regular tribute, that payment, wasn't it?
It was supposed to be, yes. And the Romans had also promised to cede Armenia to Shapur. And, you know, Armenia has been this buffer state between the Romans and Persians, the Romans and Parthians for centuries. Basically, there's always been trouble over Armenia. So Shapur says in his own account of his achievements, which we call his res gestae, like Augustus's, that Philip had lied to him. The emperor had lied. And this justified an invasion of Armenia by the Persians. Now, our evidence for this all comes from Shapur's inscription. So it is a corrective to our rather fragmentary Roman accounts, but at the same time, it is an inscription designed to glorify Shapur and his achievements. So in his res gestae, Shapur says he defeated a 60,000 strong Roman force, which was mustered at a place called Babylissos on the Euphrates. This Roman army had probably been brought together to defend Armenia. But this is the source. This is the only source we have that tells us about this. So it's clearly a disaster for the Romans. And Shapur goes on to say that during this campaign, he overruns Roman territory. He captures 37 cities in Syria and then Cappadocia, including Antioch. And this is a great blow to the Romans. You know, this is Antioch on the Orontes. It's the major city of the East together with Alexandria in Egypt. It's the seat of the governor of Syria. It's where emperors stop on their campaigns. So this is a major blow. And this is the setback which forces Valerian to travel east.
Okay. But we've got no details of how that went down, essentially, or how the capture went or the battles or anything other than Shapur's account.
So we don't have an idea of what happened at Babylissos apart from Shapur, but there are some very interesting traditions about how he managed to capture Antioch. And this is a story which appears in many sources in different versions. And this is that Antioch was betrayed by one of its own citizens, a former counselor, a decurion, so he's probably of equestrian status, called Mariades. In some sources, in other sources, he's called Syriades.
Okay.
As I said, because we have to depend on a range of both Latin and Greek accounts, we only sort of get glimpses of the story. So, for example, he's known to Ammianus, Marcellinus, writing in the 4th century, who says that, you know, he betrayed Antioch to the Persians and was then burned alive afterwards. We have another story from John Malalas, who's a 6th century chronicler, who said that because he was going to be tried for embezzling by the local council of Antioch, he went to Shapur and decided to betray them. And then we have a very shadowy account of this man called Syriades in the Historia Augusta, The Lies of the 30 Pretenders, which is basically an account of all the people who rebelled.
Who lost their rebellion efforts.
Exactly. Who rebelled under Valerian and Gallienus. And once again, he gives the story of how he betrayed Antioch to Shapur. So there's clearly one common element in all these stories is that Antioch only fell by trickery. There is one contemporary source which can shed light on this. This is a work called the 13th Sibylline Oracle. This isn't the Sibylline Oracle, the Sibylline books, which were supposed to be kept in Rome. These are what we call pseudo-prophetic texts. So it's a history written as if it was a prophecy. So it describes events as if they are going to happen.
Yeah, okay.
And it's written in Greek, and it's written by an Easterner, probably in the mid to late 3rd century. We know a lot more about this text thanks to the work of the historian David Potter. And I'm going to quote from Potter's translation here when the oracle refers to the sack of Antioch. "Alas, Antioch, they will never call you a city when you have fallen under the spear in your folly. He will leave you entirely ruined and naked, houseless, uninhabited. Anyone seeing you will suddenly break out weeping, and you will be the prize of war." So we think that he refers to Mariades there, and it's written as if it is a prophecy, something that's going to come true in the future.
Yeah.
So there is clearly contemporary evidence that Antioch was betrayed by a local man to a Shapur.
Sibylline fan fiction. This is
exactly. You know, there's a whole series of them. There's ones about Nero, for example, that predict his return from Parthia one day. And they're all written by Greeks or Hellenized Jews in the Eastern Empire.
Way after the fact.
Yes. It's a type of popular literature that sort of taps into people's hopes and dreams. So
yeah, yeah.
The Nero ones, first ones can be dated to the late 1st century, early 2nd century, and it taps into this idea whereby Nero has transformed from just any old emperor into an avenging king who will return and one day wreak destruction and avenge the little people, essentially. So Nero fits into this group of kings or charismatic leaders throughout history who will sort of lay dormant until one day they will return.
Yes.
And so the Sibylline oracles talk about Nero's return. It also talks about these people, these sort of local heroes or local enemies who will do good things or do wrong in the future.
Ultimately, Antioch is a prize of war for Shapur.
That's right. But he doesn't stay there for very long. It seems that there is a local hero who takes the fight to Shapur. Now, this is a pattern we see repeating again and again throughout the 3rd century, is that when the emperor is not there, they take matters into their own hands. And Valerian is trying to get to the east, but he's probably delayed in Asia Minor at this point, dealing with the Gothic invasions. So there's this other figure, again, another shadowy one, called Uranius Antoninus. And he is a priest from Emesa. So you might remember this is the home of the Syrian branch of the Severan family, where Elagabalus was a priest. Uranius Antoninus musters a force to beat back Shapur and the Persians. And he even mints coins, in which he is styled Lucius Julius Aurelius Sulpicius Uranius Antoninus. They exist in gold as well as silver, and they feature the conical stone Bytel, that representation of the mountain of Emesa. So harking back to Elagabalus's designs there.
So is this a tilt for becoming the emperor? Is this man trying to claim something from this victory?
Probably not. We don't know what happens to him. This is the thing.
Yeah.
So it fits into this tradition we see of local heroes that are perhaps claiming imperial authority and want recognition. But whether Uranius Antoninus wanted to be emperor, to be Valerian's colleague, is unknown because we don't know enough about him. We will meet other figures later on who definitely do want to be the emperor's colleague. So Uranius Antoninus saves the day. As I said, we don't know what happens to him. And then Valerian appears on the scene. We know he's there by January 255 because he's there to celebrate his consulship in Antioch. You know, this is a sign that the emperor is there. Rome is back in Antioch.
So while Valerian, and I'll be generous here, while Valerian has retaken Antioch from the troops of Shapur, he cannot be complacent because there's disruptions around the rest of the empire. So what takes his attention next?
Well, it's the raiding of the Goths around the Black Sea region and the northern coast of Turkey. So Zosimus, who probably relies on Dexippus, gives quite detailed accounts of these raids, which probably occurred in the mid-250s. Chronology is difficult to reconstruct. So one which he devotes quite a bit of attention to in Book 132 is a raid somewhere called Pityus on the eastern coast of the Black Sea. And this is actually in modern-day Georgia. The Romans had a settlement there and they had a detachment of troops commanded by a man called Successianus. Successianus beats off the barbarian raid and actually forces the Scythians to return home. And Valerian hears about this and actually summons Successianus to his side and makes him Praetorian prefect because of his achievements. And the two of them are based in Antioch for a while. However, this doesn't spell the end of the raids along the Black Sea. One of the serious ones, which Zosimus talks about in Book 1, Chapter 33, is a raid on the city of Trapezus. And this is later known as Trebizond. And this is where it becomes an important outpost of the Byzantine Empire in the medieval period. It's quite an interesting account. Again, it's full of detail about what happens at the local level. So Zosimus says that although they attacked the city, they, that is the Goths, did not even dream of capturing it, fortified as it was with two walls. Observing, however, that the soldiers were given over to laziness and drinking, and finally they did not even go up onto the walls, for fear of missing an opportunity for pleasure or carousing, the Scythians piled up against the wall trees which had been previously prepared for scaling it. Thus, a few at a time, during the night, they climbed up and took the city. This sudden, unexpected attack caused the soldiers to panic, and although some escaped through the various city gates, others were killed by the enemy. Thus, the city was captured, and the barbarians found an immense amount of money and great numbers of slaves, for almost all the country dwellers in the district had congregated in the city because of its fortifications. After destroying the temples, houses, and anything notable for beauty or size, and overrunning the surrounding district as well, the barbarians sailed home with a vast mass of booty.
Yeah, it sounds almost like they're leveling the place and taking everything that they can. That's what I get from that.
Yes, and you know, the other thing that's interesting is that the countryside is being denuded of people. They're all seeking refuge inside the cities themselves. So we see a lot of walls being put up around cities in Greece and Asia Minor at precisely this time, you know, cities that have never needed walls before. And this is to protect not only the people in the city itself, but also the rural population who take refuge there.
And yet you've got soldiers who are drinking, lazy, and don't want to miss out on any pleasure and carousing, and then panicking when they are attacked and escaping through the various city gates. So it sounds like some very bad discipline going on there.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to know how accurate this is because poor discipline is a bit of a topos of historiography, especially for soldiers in the East. So if you go East, you know, that is where you get seduced by all these sort of pleasures and luxuries. And it also fits into the narrative we see through these Greek sources, the local people who are the real heroes. They're the ones who manage to save the day or alternatively are persecuted and harassed, whereas the theme is very often that the imperial army doesn't help as much as it should.
Yeah, yeah. So this is the case of Trapezus, did you say?
Trapezus, yes.
But that wasn't an isolated case with this city being taken, it was happening in the area more than just that, isn't it?
Yes, exactly, exactly. Yeah. So that's just a sort of anecdote which Zosimus uses to shed light on the wider situation. There's really quite serious attacks on major cities near the Bosphorus, so Nicomedia and Chalcedon, and this forces, you know, Valerian himself to leave Syria and actually go to Asia Minor. This is a bit of a problem, however, because Shapur uses the opportunity to invade Syria again. He captures and destroys the strategic settlements of Sicensium and Dura Europus on the Euphrates, probably in 256 or 257. Mm. So certainly Shapur is taking advantage of the instability in other regions of the Roman Empire and the fact that the emperor is supposed to be there as well.
Yeah, this kind of shows the massive problem with fighting a war on more than one front. Although I imagine that Valerian would have left the area in the hands of men that he trusted, but they're just up against too much with Shapur in the area, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. You know, when the emperor isn't there, he takes the opportunity to cross the Euphrates again.
Since this is going on while his back is turned, he doesn't return to Syria at this point. We've got him heading to Europe.
That's right. So we're not quite sure why. We don't have, you know, insight into Valerian's inner thoughts, but we know that in 257 he rendezvous with his son Gallienus in Germany on the Rhine frontier.
Mm. Gallienus has been busy in the Germanic regions. What's he been up to at this point?
It's difficult to work out exactly because the Histoire Augusta's life of Gallienus basically picks up during his sole reign once Valerian is out of the picture. So we have to reconstruct what he's been doing by the evidence of coinage, inscriptions and stray references in the literary sources. So we know that he spent the years 254 to 256 in the Balkans, probably based at Viminacium in Upper Moesia. And we know that he won victory titles for his efforts to fend off the invasions of the Marcomanni and the Goths into Roman territory. So in 254, he was acclaimed Germanicus, conqueror of the Germans. And in 255, Germanicus Maximus, the greatest conqueror of the Germans. And emperors were often called greatest conquerors during this period.
Yeah.
There seems to have been some sort of diplomatic negotiations with Attalus, the king of the Marcomanni, because he was given the king's daughter, Pippa, or Pippara, as a hostage or took her as a concubine. So there's different takes on this relationship in the ancient sources. So the Historia Augusta said that he loved her, but Aurelius Victor in his book on the Caesars says that it was a disgraceful or disreputable love affair. So there's different takes on that, but we don't have enough evidence to find out what else was going on.
So this was him taking his second wife?
Well, probably not a wife, but certainly a concubine or a mistress. He's still married to Cornelia Salonina.
Okay.
So, yes.
So this isn't suddenly a new Augusta in the palace?
Oh, no, like definitely that. Not, especially since she's the daughter of the king of the Marcomanni. So, you know, that would not be a relationship that would be accepted in Rome.
Oh, well, a barbarian queen could make things quite interesting. So at this point as well, we've got the imperial dynasty being expanded officially by the way of Gallienus making his eldest son Valerian the Younger.
That's right, Valerian Junior or Valerian the Younger, that's fine.
So,
yes.
So he makes him Caesar.
That's right.
I'm surprised Gallienus has the authority to do that, but I'm assuming it's Valerian making his grandson.
Yeah, it's Valerian.
Okay. So why is this done? Why is another Caesar needed with imperial authority?
Well, this is because Gallienus plans to move to the Rhine frontier to Germany, and he wants to leave some with the imperial authority in the Balkan region, you know, assigned to the troops and to the foreigners across the Danube that, you know, there is still a member of the dynasty in charge. So Valerian Jr. is left in the Balkans and Gallienus goes to the Rhine region to deal with problems there.
So what sort of problems are happening in the Rhine?
Well, We know that significant amount of troops had been withdrawn from the frontiers there to serve in Valerian's army in the east. And this is a pattern which we see throughout the 3rd century. So what we find, particularly in the 2nd century, beginning with Marcus Aurelius's northern wars, and then in the 3rd, is that large armies or expeditionary forces, often called field armies, are made up from vexillations or detachments that are drawn from legions all across the empire. And so what we know, what Valerian was doing, actually, again, thanks to Shapur's inscription, because he tells us about the composition of his army, that Valerian was drawing strength for his field army from the legions along the Rhine and the Danube.
Mm,
so they were under strength, perhaps only half strength. And this meant that when there is raiding, regular raiding along the Rhine frontier, there aren't enough troops to deal with that because they've been sent elsewhere in the empire. And what we see from the archaeological evidence is that the Alamanni are raiding on the German frontier, and archaeological evidence shows that this was becoming so bad that civilians were actually taking refuge in forts and fortified settlements there. Mm. And so, given these problems, Gallienus decided that an emperor was needed in the region to take control and to raise morale. We don't know too much about what he gets up to there, but we know that coins are minted to commemorate the Victoria Germanica, the German victory, and he becomes Germanicus Maximus for the fifth time, the greatest conqueror of the Germans for the fifth time.
The greatest, 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 greatest,
yeah,
greatest.
Exactly, in 258. What we see at this time also is that serving in the field army becomes a great privilege because you're there with the emperor, you're there with some senatorial generals, you're there with at least one of the Praetorian prefects, you're there with the 2nd Parthian Legion, which was founded by Septimius Severus and becomes sort of the core of this field army. And one thing we see in the reign of Valerian is that centurions and tribunes who serve in the field army are given the title of protector. This actually grows into what we see in the later Roman army is a special guard corps called the protectors or the protectores in Latin. But we see individuals with the title, say, centurio protector. You know, they're centurion, but they're also protector that serves in this field army, which indicates that Valerian is trying to build some sort of special relationship between himself and his army because they are his protectors.
Yeah, yeah. And you definitely want their loyalty and that sort of relationship because so many prospective emperors have been anointed and killed by their troops.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. I know if you build that sort of special relationship, then, you know, hopefully they're going to back you to the hilt no matter what happens.
What I get from the sources at this point is that the timing of the events that we've got here become kind of very fluid as to what's happening in what order.
Yes.
I sensed in all the fragmentation that we've got with the different sources that there was a lot of confusion about what's happening where and
when. Yes. So our chronological markers that we can hang on are the coinage, the inscriptions which record victory titles, and they also tell us when new Caesars are acclaimed. These are the bones on which we hang our literary narratives that come from quite a wide variety of sources, parts of the Historiagusta, parts of Zosimus.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that at the end of 257 or beginning of 258, Valerian Jr. died in the Balkans. We don't know why.
Mm.
And he's promptly deified. So Divus Valerianus. I know there are coins for that. And we know that Gallienus' younger son, Saturninus, is now raised to the rank of Caesar, but he's not sent to the Balkans. Instead, he remains with Gallienus in Germany. And then they both take the fight to the Germans.
Mm.
We also know that Valerian had made it to Germany in 257, where he rendezvoused with Gallienus, but then by the end of the year had already set off back for the eastern frontier as well.
Now, that's a long trip. That's an exhausting thing to do, to go all the way from the east and then just turn around and promptly come back.
Yeah, I mean, he seems to have been there for several months. Some historians would even fit a visit to Rome in there as well.
Really? On your way through, maybe?
Yeah, it's very confused, the chronology.
Yeah.
But no, these are massive distances crisscrossing the empire, and it really shows how important it was for emperors to be on the frontiers in person, but also shows that Valerian thought that he needed to discuss something very important with Gallienus in 257.
And do you have any idea what that might have been?
Yes, we do. It was a persecution of the Christians.
Wow. He had to go there and discuss that in person.
We think that's what they were talking about, because persecution of the Christians, which had been in abeyance, certainly since Decius and his Edict of Sacrifice. Mm-hmm. There are some suggestions of things happening at a local level under Trebonianus Gallus, but it certainly wasn't an empire-wide persecution. But in 257 and then again in 258, decisive steps are taken against Christian clergy and then against the wider Christian population.
That was Associate Professor Kaelin Davenport, Head of the Centre for Classical Studies at the Australian National University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you may cast your pod. Please leave a review, they are always very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both of us on Twitter. Kaelin is at Dr. C. Davenport, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for Emperors of Rome. So until the next episode, I am Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.